a Motorsport Podcast Network production.
G'day everybody, Aaron Noonan here. Great to have you with me. V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco, coming to you from V8 Sleuth headquarters in Melbourne. Of course, we're backed by Repco. They're driven by passion, and so are we, celebrating their 100th anniversary in 2022. Now, a guy who is synonymous with red, he bleeds red. He was on the red side the whole way through, is my guest on the podcast this week and next week. It was such a great chat, we had to cut it up into two parts. Nathan Pretty was part of the furniture for Holden Motorsport for over a decade, driving the famous Monaro Nations Cup car that won the inaugural Bathurst 24 Hour. Rallying, he was involved in that for them as well. And of course, V8 supercars. His story is one that is quite unique and it's quite amazing. From karting to the high banks of the Calder Park Thunderdome, and then to the early days of V8 supercars as a privateer. This is the story of a Wodonga taxi driver that became a Holden Racing Team Bathurst driver. It's an amazing story of how if you're standing in front of the right door at the right time and it opens, it's amazing what unfolds. He's had an amazing career in motorsport and he's been one of the most engaging, fun and entertaining people I've met along the way. And of course, we can't do a podcast without talking with Nathan about his alter ego and his great friend, Randy Corners. There's more of that in part two next week. We talk all sorts. We talk Thunderdome. We talk V8 supercars. There's some cracking Peter Brock stories over the next couple of weeks. And of course, all of the endurance race stuff that he did. And in particular, that mighty yellow Monaro. It won the 24 Hour in 2002. And it's probably the car that he is most closely aligned with, given he drove it full time for the following seasons in the Nations Cup Series. He's a pile of fun. I really love sitting down and chatting with Nathan. It was great to have him come into the office recently. So let's get stuck into it. Here's part one of Nathan Pretty on the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco. Nathan Pretty, welcome to V8 Sleuth headquarters. I've been looking forward to this for so long because there's so much to talk about. Where do we start? Do you want to like dictate where we go from the beginning and then I'll run it from there?
I guess it starts from you ringing me, thinking that it was a pocket doll for sure, going, why would he be ringing me? Like, I'm just a nuff-nuff from Wodonga originally and going, oh, I wasn't too sure why you're ringing me for a catch-up. Did I owe you some money or something? Or?
No, not at all.
I feel privileged, mate. I'm looking forward to it.
Hey, mate, there's so much to talk about. I love your motorsport journey. Having worked with you over the years in the Holden era and you're synonymous with the red cars or the, you know, the Lion badge and other colours on the car as well. But tell me about early days. Was it karting for you? What got you started in racing? Because there's so many things we'll go on to. But if you wind it all back, whose fault is your motor racing career?
Yeah, I guess it was Dad. I mean, I started playing football, but being a bit of a gooky looking
AFL
young lad.
Yeah,
AFL. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I don't know. You don't throw a ball.
You're on the right side of the Murray River.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, I had braces. So, yeah, gooky looking young bloke.
Teeth.
And Dad thought, you know, I better maybe to protect him. We're spending the money on the teeth. I better protect him and put a helmet over his head rather than play football.
I was about to say, were you Nathan Birking it in football?
No.
As in race car
just, helmet. Yeah, and that way I wasn't going to get my teeth knocked out and all this money they were investing in them. Was just one of those things because he used to race. He raced FJs around the old Hume Weir circuit.
Oh, and gold.
Yeah, which was really cool because Dad had a couple of cars. He had and two FJs but only one engine. So on a Friday night, he'd drive to work and everything, and the Friday night he'd get home and pull the engine out of the road car and put in his race car and go racing in it, and then Sunday night would pull it back out and put it in his road car to go back to work the next week. So, you know, it was a background from motorsport that he had and wanted to, I guess, pursue that through me.
So there was Holden history way back when.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I actually come across that car. It was in an old car yard.
Really?
Wreckers in Wodonga.
I love this stuff.
Yeah,
this
it was an old FJ. And Dad was a bit of a, I guess, instigator of bonnet scoops, you know. In an FJ, he ground a couple of bonnet scoops in the FJ and pushed it in for a bit of extra forced air induction because most of that day that he was racing was all dirt. It was really cool, and I'd like to try and follow up, I guess, where that car actually has got to now.
So did you saw it though?
I did see
it. How long ago were we talking?
Oh, it'd be probably 8 years.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, 8 years ago, and it was in an old wreckers in Wodonga. But I don't think it got wrecked because it's still, you could vaguely still see Dad's name on the roof and everything.
Why didn't you buy it?
just financially not able to at the time, and probably worse so now. I mean, yeah. I'd be able to buy the valve caps. But, but yeah, I must look into it to where that's ended up.
All right, that's a bit of sleuthing. That's a mission for you when we finish this podcast. So karting, like how old are we when we go karting? And is your sister Nicole part of all this, or does she come along racing later?
She came along racing later. I mean, because I ended up getting we had a kart shop and Indy Karts in Wodonga, and, you know, I ran the kart shop because I left school halfway through year 12. It wasn't really for me, and, you know, looking back, it would have been nice to finish my schooling. I was only had another 6 months to go, but had the go-kart shop and did that, but went racing karts, and, you know, Dad was away away working all the time, and then he'd come back, and on a Friday night we'd go somewhere in Victoria pretty much, all through the country series and city series, and go racing. And then he'd come back on a Sunday night and then kind of go back to work and everything again, which was pretty hard on the relationship, I think, with Mum and Dad and my two elder sisters. But it was good. You know, it was one of those things. And unfortunately, with karting and then progression, we just did not have the money to go Formula Ford open wheeler racing.
Which was the next step, really.
Which was the next step. And even to this day still, I have not driven a Formula Ford or Formula V or open wheel car.
All right, we've got to change this.
Which is a bit kooky. I've driven a Radical. That's about as close to open wheel that I've ever driven.
That's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's what your wallet dictates.
That's exactly right. And we just didn't have it. We didn't have the funds to do that because it was so expensive, even though it
was. And how were you funding this? Was it Dad just going, right, I'll sort it out? Or were
it was one of those. Yeah. Look, it was, unfortunately, Dad's wallet. It was one of those. I wouldn't say I was a sorth, the old son of a rich father. It definitely wasn't one of them. But Dad, you know, he liked the fact that we had a really good relationship with going away racing and different things. And, yes, look, at times it was tested because it's competitive. And certainly then progression then to go on to the Thunderdome, where we bought an old VK Commodore and went Thunderdome racing, oval track racing, because that was our progression, was to do that way, you know, to go bitumen racing round and round circles. And that way I couldn't stuff it up. I couldn't turn left.
So basically it's the wallet that dictates. It's not that you're thinking you're the next Brad Jones. You're going, well, this is where we can go. This is what we can do. And it turned out to be a great thing for you to go to Thunderdome. Oscar was booming. You start in Sportsman, which for those who might not remember, was the old Oscars that they brought in. It was the Super 2 of Oscar, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, that's right. It was. It was a, you know, VK Commodores, XF Falcons.
Where'd you get your Commodore from?
I can't remember his name now, but it was like down in Melbourne. That was down in Melbourne, and then we brought it up to Wodonga and did it up and everything as best you can do an old race car up, and it was good. I really enjoyed it. I loved it. And the fact that then with having Brad Jones in Albury, the other side of the river, the progression then was to go Oscar racing. So, you know, I think we finished in the top three in the championship that first year in the Sportsman, and then progressed on to Oscar racing, and Brad and Kim took me under their wing to give us a hand with Dad and I, because it was a self-funded family team pretty much. And so I had my mum doing catering, my elder sister was doing catering as well, and Nicole was helping do a lot of the mechanical stuff as well with the car, until the point where we, a couple of years into it, we had enough components to build another car. And that's where Nicole came into the whole scene.
And at the time, I've talked to some of the guys, particularly this year, Brad, Terry Wyhoon. Our listeners love hearing Thunderdome stories and that era, because, of course, it doesn't go anymore. It's done and dusted. But what are your memories of it, the camaraderie, the racing? And it was in a way that the prize money could help you fund your racing that sponsorship couldn't.
Well, that's the thing, and we were fortunate enough, and I mean I'd like to actually do a legit check on it, but we were rumored to be the first in the world to have Caterpillar as a worldwide motorsport sponsor. So Judy Littlewood here in Melbourne, part of the Caterpillar family, she looked after all the marketing for Caterpillar, and we approached them, and at the time it was a good marketable thing for them.
And this was before the John Bauer Cat
Supercat. This was 92. This is in my rookie season that they come on board in a little way, and then it progressed that next year to have Caterpillar all down the side of the car and everything, to have, you know, a lot of their different people, clients and things come along to the racing and old school style to cater for them and take them out, do them something, take them to something different rather than take them to a quarry. So that was really cool. And, you know, we were fortunate to have them for a number of years in Oscar, which was great. But, yeah, the camaraderie side of it, that's where Oscar racing was just an unbelievable category to be involved in, because we spent the whole off-season rebuilding our old Oscar. And unfortunately, the only thing we didn't replace was a $20 ball joint. So the practice for the new season, I think it was 92, 93 season, it broke a ball joint going into turn one. So I hit the fence into turn one at about 180 kilometres an hour, and I didn't come off the fence until well out of turn two, halfway up the back straight. So that rattled me bones a little bit and everything, but we were disappointed because we had a big sponsor we had to represent, and Terry Wyheen had an old car down in Currumburra. We loaded up a couple of the guys to go down and get the old shell, and they brought it back up, and we made the grid, you know, thanks to Terry lending us a car and everything. We rebuilt this car into what we had was I guess our car, so we could make the field for that first race of the season, which was fantastic.
Was that the biggest shunt that you had at the Thunderdome?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. When you've got no idea what's going to happen. I mean, some of these others you can at least brace for it, but popping down into turn one at those sort of warp speeds and jumping on the brakes and the ball joint just letting go and just fired me straight up into the fence. And that fence doesn't move. It's a hard fence. So
it's a one-way conversation.
But those seats, you know, those Butler-built aluminium seats, which they still run in NASCAR today, yes, albeit a lot more refined, it took all the absorption and it blew all out my rib cage protector and everything. And I walked away from that thing, you know, like it was a little car park crash.
Probably wasn't really.
No, it definitely wasn't. But it was one of those things. You know, those cars were built really well.
What's your standout memory of the Oscar stuff and the Dome? Because it wasn't just the Dome. There was a bit of road course racing among it. But is there a standout race, a win, a battle that lives on, or some of the guys you raced against that really sticks out?
Yeah, I guess a lot of the racing back then was really cool because the camaraderie was there. I guess some of the fiercest competitors were obviously BJ. I mean, he was a champion of that category for such a long time. But with the likes of Terry and Bruce Williams, and then also Johnny Faulkner. I mean, you know, I remember telling myself that, geez, I don't really want to push it too much harder because I might crash the car and everything. And after qualifying, I think I'd qualified third or fourth, and Johnny was, I think, might have been only second. I said, "How'd you go, John?" He goes, "No, no good." I said, "Oh, what, not happy with second front row?" He goes, "No, I didn't scare myself." And I thought, oh, okay. I walked away from that going, oh, okay, I better man up, better tighten the crutch strap a bit more next time and give it a red hot go, because I wasn't in that position to go and do that, because I knew that if I damaged the car, I was the one to fix it. You know, we weren't paying anyone. It was all a voluntary team, and, you know, we had a great bunch of guys from our local area in Albradonga helping us out, volunteering to come down, and, you know, and they would help to fix it as well. But I took that responsibility on my back to then fix the car if I actually damaged it. So it's one of those things. I guess it probably held me back from a lot of other racing and so on in the future, because I still had that mentality that if I crashed it, I didn't expect someone else to fix my stuff up.
Yeah. No. You bend it, you fix it.
Yeah. It was
very
one of
simple.
Those things.
Very simple philosophy.
But it held me in good stead, you know. And at the end of the day, I finished a lot of races because of having that mentality, hand the car back over to the main driver and so on, so that we could get to the finish line. Because in go-karting, a guy pulled me aside one time, and I was very fast in karts, but I was crashing a fair bit, you know, just a wild child. And he pulled me aside, and that old analogy of, you know, to finish first, you first must have to finish. And he just walked away. And
did you even know this bloke?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, right.
He was just some
random guy giving you a bit of experience 101.
He was my engine builder, and made me really think about it, you know. And I came back, and he said, "Did you ever think about that?" And I'm like, "I don't really understand what you mean, you know." and he sort of put it a bit more clear, and then so I changed the way I raced even then. And it was just about gathering points and everything and being there at the end of the day. And I started to win a lot more races by just playing a lot smarter. You didn't always have to be the fastest, but you had to be smart. And I guess that went on right through my whole career because, you know, I was definitely not the fastest in a lot of categories and so on, but used my head and my nous to try and keep the thing on the track to get there in the end because the other thing was about the sponsorship, and sponsorship was hard to get, and to be able to still represent that brand you had on the side of the car, you needed to be out there in front of the cameras and doing it that way.
Well, that flowed right through, as you said, because I brought with me just thinking that we will talk about this later, but, I mean, you did 14 Bathurst 1000s and you finished 12 of them. Yeah. So, you know, and more often than not, you know, you were a top 10, top 12 runner when you're in the second car or if you're backing up the main guy. So same approach that carried right through from there. Now it makes total sense when I look at your record moving forward in the other categories and the Nations Cup and the Supercar Enduros, your finishing rate's so high comparatively for that top level of the sport because it was ingrained in you that I can't really go too wild here.
Yeah, and because
Did that hurt you later on?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. I know it did because, you know, I had an opportunity to have some full-time gigs in Supercar, but I, for whatever reason, it was always in the back of my mind just to hold it back a bit, hold it back a couple of tenths and so on rather than bin it and try to prove yourself that you're super fast but you're a crasher, rather than just to hold it back that little bit but to finish all the time and just put the time on the board. And I know it definitely hurt later on, but, you know, I feel very privileged for some of the teams and team owners and cars that I've driven over my time. So, you know, I don't look back and feel ill-hearted about it because it was my choice to do that in the first place.
Do you remember your first Oscar win?
Yeah, I do, yeah. It was a rain-shortened race, I think, a little bit because, you know, same. There was pit stops and all this sort of thing, but it was five-wheel nuts, you know, and it was a manual
jack.
It was all this sort of thing that our guys worked pretty hard to do that and to get the pit stops right and to cut some time there so you could pass some cars in pit lane and so on. And, yeah, it was at the Thunderdome and it was a bit rain-shortened by probably 10-odd laps, but I think I beat Marshall to the flag in the end because they called it in the end. But that was really cool, you know, knowing that all our guys, as I said, they're all volunteers and everything to get a win because I'd always had a lot of seconds and thirds and so on, and over the time still a lot of seconds and thirds. And I loved going to Adelaide to AIR there, short track.
Yeah, it was like the bull ring. Real bull ring, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was very cool. I mean, and unfortunately for me, I've got a bad memory there. I was taking someone for a ride. We had a ride car.
Yeah.
And I was taking someone for a ride and I was coming in the pits and hit the pit wall coming in. So it was a good ride for them.
That was an experience of a ride that you normally don't get.
Yeah, that's right. There you go. You're not having one of them again.
No. So I hope you enjoyed it. One time only. Yeah. One time only. Who was the hardest competitor at the Dome?
Oh, I think Johnny, as I said before, Johnny Faulkner's attitude, he was win it or bin it. There was no denying that. He won a lot of races, but he had a lot of crashes and big crashes too, and he had a lot. But I guess, and Brad, you know, when Brad was still racing the Oscars, their true professionalism in the sport was hard to beat, and that was a tough one to always look up to him, but it was also really good to have them knowing that I was under Brad's wing a little bit with helping out in learning the sport and the tactics involved in that, because there was a lot involved in that. And as you still see today with NASCAR racing, they've lost a bit of that old school redneck type thing because of the way the cars are developed now, more through safety side of things. But it was really cool to be involved in it. And I guess some of those other guys, Terry was always very hard, but I think he had the same strategy as me, you know, knowing that it was a hard fought battle just to get there to race each time. So he still won a lot of races and championship and everything as well. But I think getting back to when you asked before about that, they had a NARA fund. It was called a NASCAR and Oscar Repair Association Fund or something like that.
Yeah.
And if you crashed your car, they pulled a certain percentage of the prize money out and pulled it. So instead of getting $20,000 to win, which was big prize money back then, they would pull X amount of percentage out of that. So you might have only won $15,000. And write down, because it didn't matter where you finished, you would win some prize money.
All you had to do was basically turn a lap.
That's right, and you would get some prize money. But also then with that NARA fund, where the cars started, the field started to, I guess, lessen each time, and they realised that it was hard, it was a battle for a lot of these teams to get to the next race. So they made this NARA fund, and they took a lot of the percentage away. And then so if you crashed, you would get a certain percentage. You'd have to put your quote in. and they would look at it, and then depend on if you were the only person to crash, you would get most of that pool
from
of
that
money
round
and accidentally make money
to crash.
To crash. You know, as silly as it sounded, it was a really, really good idea. And I mean, to the point where, you know, the old, there's no, I guess, warranty on a race engine. So it's hard to try, and if it blows up, it's the old concrete. Well, you drove it out on the concrete to get onto the trailer, so there's your warranty. It's null and void now. You're going racing with it. And my sister, she blew an engine up at one stage, and we got money to repair it through the NARRA fund. I mean, and that just doesn't happen. Yes, if you crash and so on, but once again, yeah, if there was a big crash and a lot of cars get taken out, then, yeah, I guess your NARRA fund and your repayments for that race weren't going to be so great, but they still helped you get your car fixed and get it to the next race.
It's a great part of that whole scenario, that crashing actually earned your money, which is
I know, hard to believe.
A little nuts in the way that the sport generally.
Yeah, because a lot of people made a lot of money out of that.
What was the we talked about it before, the prize money was probably the place's downfall, really, because Bob put out big prize money, which a lot of teams, you know, particularly in those last 3 or 4 years, there weren't too many cars with lots of signage on them. The television package wasn't as prominent as it had been previously. So there comes a point where you just can't keep paying out all that money. But for you guys, was that better than sponsorship, the prize money? Without that, you wouldn't have been there.
No, that's right. I mean, it certainly helped because our prize money wasn't massive. The actual sponsorship stuff was not massive, but it was good to represent some of these big brands, you know. We had DeWalt and so on as well. So the money wasn't huge, but yeah, you relied on a fair bit of that sponsorship as well. You know, it wasn't something that I could, even though through the week, most of the weeks I was back at our workshop rebuild. I was running the go kart shop, but rebuilding the race cars and so on to get ready for that next race.
And are you employing anyone to help you run these Oscars?
No, employing no one.
It's just your mates coming and helping at a round at the Dome or come in Adelaide and pit crewing.
So we obviously just covered all their costs involved in that, but we couldn't afford to pay anyone, to the point where I think it wasn't until I was probably, well, the Holden Racing Team was the first time I got paid to race because even through the week I wasn't getting paid to work on the car. It was taking probably $200, still living at home, so probably making about $150 a week. Which wouldn't even cover going out drinking. So, I hardly ever, went out or anything like that too. Back then it was one of those things. I was focused on my racing and trying to be fit but look after the race cars, and because we just couldn't afford to pay anyone. It was just really tough all the way up until 2000.
You said before about you went to two cars because Nicole, your sister, started racing as well at the Dome. That's a pretty cool thing. There's not too many brothers and sisters that can say they've raced at a really high level in Australian motorsport in the same races. It's pretty rare.
Yeah, absolutely. It was nice time because to get Nick involved, I think she also won the Rookie of the Year. I won the Rookie of the Year and she won the Rookie of the Year in the Oscar as well, which was really cool because at one point we had enough components. We had three cars. We had two race cars and a designated ride car because we built all our sponsorship through Brad and Kim off the back
of the way they did it.
Yep. We marketed ourselves off the back of them and we had that designated ride car where we sold, because it was honestly, I think going for a ride in an Oscar still to this day was probably one of the best experiences I've had, even going around.
I've done it. It was cool. I went with Marshall Brewer one day in a fast track car at the Dome.
Yep.
And I've been lucky enough in what I do and the time I've been around to go for some rides in some cool cars at some cool tracks. The Dome's like vying for the gold medal because it was so unique, so different, so against what your brain is wired from a circuit racing perspective. The speed, the noise, so cool.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because it is one of those things. And as I said, we'd have ride days there with the sponsors. We'd have 120 people lined up there where Nick and I would just jump in and out of the driver's seat, and as fast as we could get them in there, we were going out doing rides. And, we would do days all over the country. Even if we weren't racing in Perth, we'd take the car across there because Caterpillar was a huge part of their business was over in WA, and we'd take the car over there and do rides around Wanneroo or something with the Oscar, which was a bit bizarre, but it was still a ride car, and back then not many people were actually doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, the Jones boys were probably the good guys to be learning off, because they know how to hustle, they know how to do deals, they know how to make stuff happen, particularly in those days. So was there Albury-Wodonga rivalry there? Because they're on that side of the border. Yeah. You're the newbies on the other side of the border. Were they always helpful, or did you start to get a bit more competitive and they started to not help you as much?
Yeah, no, they were. They were always, I mean, they were, yeah, we were the Mexicans, so they weren't too worried about us. I mean, even though they had to come over to our side of the state to go racing most of the time, but no, they were very helpful right through our whole time. I mean, to the point where I don't think I was really ever a threat, because Brad was out of Oscar racing anyway and they were in the NASCAR side of things then, which obviously then takes up a lot more time. But it's quite bizarre. I mean, they're still in the same factories, you know, that they were back in the early 90s. So it's, you know, that's just how far they've come, I guess, with supercar racing. Yeah. It was back then, it was like supercar racing. That's not part of us. We're rednecks. We're old school.
We're oval trackers.
Yeah, we're going to stick with that. They didn't want any part of that until, unfortunately, I think it was roughly December of 99 when the old Oscar NASCAR, and it was the last race that we had in the Thunderdome. And which is, yeah, I drive past it every single day now still. And I look in there and it just saddens me that we're not in there anymore.
Yeah. Did you see the writing on the wall?
Kind of. Unfortunately, I mean, he went and invested a lot of money in those lights, and that built the sport up again. You know, people would come out on a Friday or Saturday night.
Oh, I have great memories. Yeah, Saturday night.
Massive crowds.
Down from Ballarat. Crowds. You know, you'd get there at like 6 o'clock-ish. You're there till, I think curfew was 11, wasn't it, the last that the racing could run. You'd get NASCAR, Oscar, Sportsman, HQs belting themselves to pieces, the little legends up and down the pit apron. It was 2020 motor racing before there was 2020 cricket. Compact, you could see it all right in front of you, 4 and a bit, 5 hours in of a window. If you wanted to go and watch qualifying early in the day, you could, but perfect.
Oh, like 100%.
It would be so suited to the now of the sporting environment, television, people's, you know, attention spans, all that stuff. Yeah. It would be ace.
Oh, look, it'd need a fair bit of money spent on the track, unfortunately, because of the way it was built back in the day and modelled off Charlotte, just a little bit compacter circuit than Charlotte was. But I guess right here, right now, if I was in a wheelchair, walking stick, whatever, and they brought Oscar, you know, NASCAR racing back to Australia, I'd be finding my way there somehow to do it, you know, or to have some sort of team. And because it's still well inside me to get back there and do some form of that racing. I love the NASCAR racing. There's no denying that.
There's a lot of love from so many people who listen to our podcast, from fans out there. Whenever we talk NASCAR, Oscar, Thunderdome, or we do stuff on the website, it lights up. So there's clearly, and a little bit of it's the rose-coloured glasses, a little bit of, oh, it was better back in the day and all that sort of stuff. But enough times passed, you know, as you said, it was, what, December 99 that the last race on the Dome was. You know, we're 2022 now, so 20-plus years. There's a lot of love. There's a lot of love out there for that form of racing, which basically ran for 10 years pretty much, give or take a year, and then it all just went.
Unfortunately, and probably now that these Holdens are getting more valuable, there's
don't want to race them.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, yes, the newer models and stuff are a little bit different. There's a lot of them around, but I guess some of these HQ owners would just look at that joint and just cringe, you know, because I've seen some of those HQ crashes where there was 15 to 20 cars taken out in one crash. It was amazing.
I do recall there was a fellow in a Sportsman Falcon. I think his name was Graham O'Brien. Had a mammoth rollover down the back straight. He went about 9 times over. It was so big it went worldwide. It was on those American and they walked away TV type shows. But I'll never forget, and we're diverging here, but it's Thunderdome, so it's cool. I was a young motorsport news reporter at the time, still at school. I think my dad was taking me to get in the media center. He got a free ticket, so he was sweet. And Bargs arrived, and Bargs said, I knew there'd been a big shunt when I was driving through the tunnel because I saw three springs flying and smash into the fence above my car.
It was massive.
And so when you shunted at the Dome, it was generally a big shunt.
Unfortunately, yeah. And even getting back to one of those HQ crashes, for the leaders, I know that there was – like it might have been the fourth, fifth and sixth guys got bunched up and crashed in behind first, second and third – and yet they come all the way around and still got involved in the same crash. Like, that's how bad things
that's
were,
unfortunately. That's not good.
That's not good. When you had about, what, 1.6 Ks, I think it was, to know something's wrong, that there was no one behind you and still come around and get involved in that crash, it's not great for your spotter. I mean,
not a good
let's
look.
Be honest.
Not a good look. You talked about your love for NASCAR. People forget that you did have a go at NASCAR. You're pretty much an Oscar guy, but a little chance popped up to drive the car that Kevin Schwantz and Murphy driven as well. Tell me about how that all popped. Scott Williams is the man to blame for that, isn't
he? Yeah, Scotty I've known for a long time, and he gave me the opportunity, and it was actually that night that I met my wife, who I'm still with now.
Wow.
So she watched me.
Yes, do tell
her. Crash both cars, an Oscar and a NASCAR, and somehow still managed to get together. So pretty impressive. I impressed the hell out of her.
Was she there to see you? Did she know who you were?
No, she didn't. She came down with some friends from Wodonga. She was a Corion girl and still is. She's back up there now. But she was there that night and I met her. But it was that NASCAR, it was cool to do. It was a very short and steep learning curve. To unwind from going clockwise for so long to go anti-clockwise on a big radial slick tyre was just a different beast to drive. Mm. It was thrown in the deep end. I mean, I'd done enough laps in an Oscar. I thought that I'd go all right in a NASCAR, but it was challenging. It was very hard. You know, I just needed a lot more time. I wouldn't say I was even competitive on that night because, unfortunately, as I said, I crashed and I hit someone in the that was having their own accident in the infield, and I'd just come off turn four and, you know, got a little bit sideways as well and tried to avoid a crashing car but then hit the crashing car, unfortunately.
Got involved in the crash.
Yeah, it was like, stay high. You know, it was none of that, unfortunately. I try and teach it these days now is don't look at what you don't want to hit, but I was staring at it. I couldn't take my eyes off him, so I thought I'd get involved in his accident. No, not a good look.
Trick for young players to not follow.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right. Yeah, don't do it.
If in doubt, don't aim at the car. So we kind of have covered that Oscar NASCAR winds itself down. As it's winding down, you go to V8 Supercar. So was this a case of sponsor pressure or seeing that, hey, that V8 thing's taking off now, we've got to get among it? What was the take that got you? Because you're doing it all on your own. So this is a big step to go into the supercar. And this is before there's a Super 2. This is going into the main championship.
Yeah, this was all Shell Series still. Because we had a good sponsor in DeWalt at the time, and, you know, with that winding up, we still wanted to keep those guys on board. And I guess for Dad, his childhood dream was to probably have raced at Bathurst. Mm. And unfortunately, you know, he couldn't do it, but he'd love to have seen us do it. So that's where we had the chance, I guess, to try and do it, but to do that, we needed to buy a supercar. So Dad started doing his research and, I guess, found a car over in WA from the Johnsons, which is an old Perkins car, and he ended up going over and checking it out and, ended up buying it, and we brought it across. And I guess that's where the old foundation started, where to get to Bathurst in 98 was to rebuild this car and try and make his childhood dream come to fruition through us. And, it was really cool. It was a long slog. We had to build everything pretty much and learn a fast learn, steep learning curve in what to do with a supercar, because totally different beast. There's no more, quadrajet carby anymore. This is all injected. It's a
different,
lot different.
Whole different game.
Yeah.
So was it part of the deal of buying the car from, so this is the Grant Johnson who you raced Utes against later on down the track. So part of the deal that he gets to co-drive at Bathurst and Nicole's part of the lineup as well. So it's a real family team, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well and truly. And that was part of the deal where I guess we saved a little bit of money knowing that we were going to take the car to Bathurst in 98 and have Grant come on board and co-drive with us and Nicole, hopefully as well. But it was a tough slog for her to try and learn that when she hadn't done a lot of that, circuit racing in a car. But it was a good opportunity. I mean, unfortunately, and, after all the work, the pre-season stuff and getting the car ready just for that one race, we were 19 laps from the end and the little alternator decided to pack it in and we just didn't have the spares to fix it to get to the finish line, unfortunately.
What was the most desperate thing you did in that period? Of course, you said about you started to get paid when you got the HRT opportunity. We'll talk about that in a minute. what's the most desperate thing you did back in those days, whether it was karting or the super speedway stuff or that early V8 supercar to go racing? How desperate did you get?
I was driving taxis. I drove taxis for a number of years in Wodonga in the lead up to even in 98, you know, 98, 97, I think, 97, 98, 99. I was baking bread at Sunnycrust. You know, I was pouring concrete. I had about four different jobs just to, I guess, make enough money to then to tip into the racing as well to try and top it up as best I can. I mean, it's not even topping up. I don't think I was even paying for the fuel we were using, but, you know, I sort of thought I was doing my little bit. But, yeah, the desperation and stuff and the commitment I had was pretty high to try and get there. You know, it was what I'd always wanted to do as well. Then after I knew back in the day started racing go-karts to then to try and race at Bathurst, because I used to sit down and watch Bathurst and watch Brocky and Dick Johnson and, you know, Moff and all these guys, you know, throw their cars around, which was a very different era, I guess, to even when I started racing up there. But I idolised these guys and I wanted to be like them, like a lot of other little kids, you know. A little bit different now. They want to be the Craig Lowndes or the Jamie Wincups and stuff, but I was that little kid.
I love the story, and you can tell it better than I can because you were there. So you get this V8 supercar, the old Alf Barbagallo car. It was old by the time you got it. I think it was about 6 years old. But the next year you did a few rounds of the championship, and this is still the main game. This is not getting fobbed off to the development series. This is the real deal. So at Winton, old Nathan Pretty in his old clunker Commodore finishes seventh in the main game against the big hammer boys, all the factory teams. The fields are like 40 cars in those days. Tell me about how that all unfolded, because it was a little Oscar NASCAR spotter trick that helped you avoid an incident, and it was Nicole that was, I think, on the radio that helped you avoid something that most other people didn't.
Yeah, correct. She was up near the old start-finish line with the radio as a spotter. I mean, not
which
that
is what you had on the dome
at the dome, so to try and avoid the crashes and so on. And yeah, I guess I qualified 25th, which was a surprise anyway, because you had to pre-qualify and stuff sometimes.
So you're definitely not last. You're already
we're up, and that was that first race, and I don't think I'd even really done a proper sprint round start. So, you know, to throw me in the deep end, because we couldn't afford to practice these starts and things as well, because it puts so much load on the car.
Yeah.
And I guess I don't know what lap it was at what stage, but we were, you know, I was holding my own and so on, probably made up a couple of spots running about 23rd. And there was a bit of oil down through the sweeper, and Nick gets on the radio going, they're all shooting off at the sweeper. So slow right down. And as I was coming through the old, I think, what was it, five, and then coming up to the sweeper, I slowed right down and a couple of cars fired past on the outside around me. So I let them go and I just wobbled around like it was wet, and they just fired straight off. And all the other cars, there was cars everywhere off.
There were more off than on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And wobbled around and stayed on the circuit and come around and then continued on and just kept wobbling around the sweeper because I knew there was oil down, because Nick had told me through the spotter, through the radio. And I guess, and ended up finishing seventh. So it was a bit of a surprise. I mean, the old girl had never probably started that high up in its life, unless Larry drove it when he first built it.
Yeah, it was a phenomenal. I mean, 24th, 5th, whatever it was, to 7th. But then you came back to earth in the next one, didn't you?
Yeah, real fast. And as I said, it just comes back to that not being able to afford to do practice starts and things. And I was starting alongside Scafey in the factory HRT car, and I thought, you know what?
This is my day.
Yeah. I know you're probably going to jump me, but I'm on the inside. So I'm going to have a red hot go to try and stay up as far as I can through the race. But, very short lived. As soon as it went green, the old girl, she snapped an axle and my day was done. Well, that race was done. So, very hard hit back down to earth.
The motor racing gods just slapped you straight across.
Oh, yeah,
gave you a big leg up in the previous one and then just cut you straight back down a size,
which was disappointing. But in that saying that, because I didn't have power steering and so on as well, so it was a battle out there, like through the S's and things and the boobs over the back there. I was literally two hands on one side. Those big slick tyres, no power steering. It was a battle to try and get that car through there every lap, you know. And I guess in some way or another, I was kind of a little bit thankful because I was thinking I was pretty buggered after that first race. But it is one of those things that was disappointing, but it did, I guess, put my name out there, and that's how it come to get me a bit of a test there with HRT anyway.
It was pretty hard for privateers to get much of an, you know, time on television, or and that's why they brought that Privateers Cup in with those Saturday afternoon races back in those days that was on trackside, you know, a week later or whatever it was. But as you said, the phone rings the next year though.
Yeah.
And surely, so by 99, you do Bathurst later in the year, I think with Andrew Fawcett, the Kiwi, who came over and drove with you. You did that Bob Jane 300 Bathurst Tourer thing up at Bathurst in the wet, which I think we're all drying out from still.
It that's right. Yeah, and that was a good thing because I spent that off-season then, you know, the supercar in the back blocks a little bit, this I guess other category was coming on, the Future Tourer, and so we converted one of our Ross cars, which was just sitting in the workshop in the corner there gathering dust, and I put doors on it and put a cage in it for the doors and things, and I converted it all myself. And, yeah, we went up there and had a good race. I mean, it was great because I do remember Brocky giving us a really good rap on the radio, on the telecast, and unfortunately we just made the wrong choice in coming in for tyres to get to the end of that race, and they called the race because it was so wet, but I was having a really good wet race. So I just had a different, I guess, technique in the rain, and it was that whole just steady, nice and steady, and get to the finish line and let everyone else sort of run off and crash and so on, which a lot of them did. But I had a good race then, and yeah, unfortunately as well for getting to Bathurst then in the with the supercar, it didn't go to plan because I crashed it in qualifying. I thought everything was going pretty good and I'd done some pretty good times and everything, and straight out there, the old young bloke, cold tyres.
And then?
Fucked up.
And if you haven't, if you're wondering, where have I heard that before? So that's an infamous line that so many people in our industry wheel out, because at the time there was a documentary being made about supercars. I think it was called In the Pits. And Larry Perkins watches the vision of you crashing at the top of the hill on the TV in the pit lane. And I can't remember who he turns to. Maybe Jack. Maybe it was Jack. I can't remember. And delivers that infamous, line that you just said. I won't go. Look, we're okay with a swear word or two. It's okay. But it's part of the vernacular of a V8 supercar racing now. If anybody wheels that out, pretty much everyone in the paddock knows exactly, and it's all your fault.
Yeah, I do remember it because we featured in that documentary quite a bit after that incident, and I just remember seeing Larry laying in his beanbag, I think it was in pit lane at the time, when he turned and said those words. But it was embarrassing, but it's a good, you know, I guess, kick in the guts to know that you need to take things, I guess, steady, and I was feeling quite confident, but you do get brought back down to earth very fast. And unfortunately, I mean, we finished the race that year after then spending all the practice and everything rebuilding the car just to get to the start line. And I do remember starting in, I think it was 54th or thereabouts.
53rd. I've got it on the sheet here.
Which meant I had to actually change up and back down a gear before I got to the start line, because I was up around the corner. That doesn't happen anymore.
No. That was the first year of the race being part of the championship. In 99, and that was a full 55-ish car field back in the maximum days of the field. So we get to the end of 99. You've had a bit of a taste of V8 supercars, and, you know, the Thunderdome's wound down, so that's not an option anymore. In 2000, for the first part of that year, there's nothing going on. You pretty much going, I think I'm done here.
Yeah, I was just, I guess, realising that probably driving taxis is going to be my job.
Were you driving Commodore taxis or Falcons?
Unfortunately, it's the only time, apart from the very first car I had, which was an XF Falcon, I was driving Falcons because they were really good taxis, and that's what they made, really good taxis. I mean, still to this day, I've never driven a Ford race car. I mean, albeit the taxi had numbers on its door.
Yes.
But they were government numbers.
Not race numbers.
No, but that's the only time, and I was still driving the taxis and all the rest of it, and as I said, bacon bread, and I was concreting. And I was away concreting at the time when I got a phone call, and I dead set thought it was one of my mates just taking the mickey out of me. And when he said, it's Jeff Greck, you know, and I'd like to know if you want to come in and have a chat about coming up for just a test, not lead to anything, but just come and have a drive of a factory car. And I do remember vaguely almost hanging up on him.
thinking that someone's pulling my
leg. Oh, yeah, for sure. Because I hadn't raced anything.
You've gone in a couple of months into that year. You haven't been racing anything.
Mm.
Winter 99's forgotten.
Yeah.
Why are they ringing me? And actually, it's an interesting insight at the time because they had their drivers for the endurance races locked earlier in the year. And then suddenly they announced Mark Noske wasn't going to be driving after announcing him as one of their drivers.
Yeah.
So at the time, and this is, I love how we can click these stories together now because at the time we couldn't. I was at Motorsport News. And so the news comes through that Noske's out. So the instant chat is, who are they going to get? So everyone starts to ring their sources to find out who's there. Phil Brannigan had a really strong Formula Ford background. Mate, Gavin Monaghan's going to get a drive. And we all went, Gavin Monaghan? Well, that's left field. And then Gerald McDornan, who was really solid with Super Speedway and NASCAR Oscar and drag racing, comes in. And he's a Wodonga boy too.
Yeah.
Was he all pretty? No, he's Wodonga, isn't he?
He's Wodonga.
He's up from that way. He's on the good side of the border. Nathan Pretty's going to get a drive. And we all went, geez, this is interesting. Holy hell.
Yeah.
So it was off the radar for everybody else, and clearly it was off the radar for you too. Like,
yeah, it was. Surprised and it was, I guess, thanks to Richard who was dating Nicole years prior, and he was a big HRT man, and he'd been there for a long time. And he'd been at Brad's
before that, hadn't he?
He had. So he basically got me the test because he said, "Look,
let's give him a go.
It's not going to lead anything. Everything's locked away, but it'd be a good opportunity. You know, I've seen what you've done on radial tyres and things. Just come and have a drive in your supercar, no power steering, all the rest of it. Come and have a drive. Do a few laps in a factory race car, and you know, just see how you go. Just enjoy it. So yeah, I went up to Winton, and as it turned out, it went really well. It was just an animal to drive. It was so good. It was one of the best things I'd ever driven.
Did you want to go home and burn your car after driving that one?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think even by that time, our car was up for sale and so on because reality had kicked in that it's just a big bucket that we just can't keep filling up. It's just empty and faster than we can even get it to any sort of level. And it was just an enjoyable experience, you know, to go up there and drive. I think I drove Craig's car at the time, a VT Commodore, and did a couple of laps and no times. I didn't know how to read. We had an old PI system in our car and we didn't have times on the dash or any of that sort of thing. It's just old stopwatch stuff and everything. and it was across the radio to Dad going, yeah, that was shit. You're going to have to go faster sort of stuff. Whereas
high tech.
Yeah, I didn't know about looking at the dash for times and things, even in their car. So I just went out there and just enjoyed it and come in and they asked me a few questions about the car and so on. And I gave them my feedback and they went back and that was all it was going to be. And then they said, would you like to have another drive? I'm like, oh.
Same day or another day?
Yeah, same day. Yeah. No, same day. And it's like, he did a good job and your feedback was really accurate and would like to, you'd have another drive. So I jumped back in again and I think at that stage we were starting to get into the happy hour time. Even back then it still did that and the track was starting to come pretty good. And to get a drive in a car at the end of the day is a really cool thing because the track's coming to you. And went out there and I think Murph was in the Kmart car and he was just in front of me, I think, and I was catching him. And I didn't know what's going on or anything. I just, you know, then they've just called me in and asked my feedback and all the rest of it again. And I went and got changed and they just said, you know, did a really good job. How'd you enjoy it? And I just, once again, gave my feedback, thought it was the best thing I'd ever done. That's for sure. Certainly the most fun I'd ever had with my pants on at that stage because it was such a nice car to drive compared to my old girl that I'd been wrestling around that track for so many years anyway. And, yeah, and then it just later on and I got another phone call. Yeah.
What was that phone call?
That was from Jeff to say, would I like to come up to Winton, to the Winton round and just have a chat about a couple of things. And I didn't know what
was going thinking? On. Oh, my God, I'm going to get a chance, or are you thinking?
No, I just still didn't know. You know, I'm thinking the next year, or I didn't know what was happening with their endurance lineup and so on. I mean, so as it turned out, I come up there and I was having a talk to Dad, and Dad said to me, he was quite excited, and he said, look, we'll sell the holiday house. If you get offered a drive, we'll sell the holiday. We'll make it work, you know. And
i.e. to buy the drive.
Yeah, to buy the drive. Yeah, if you get offered a drive, because that's just what happens back then, and certainly to drive for the factory team. I mean, it is one of those things that we're going to have to come up with some decent money, and so we'll do this and we'll make it work. Just talk to us, let them know that we'll get back to you. And so Dad and I drove up to Winton and went in there while I was having dinner one night and sat down with Jeff and had dinner with the guys and everything. And Dad was waiting in the car out in the car park and, you know, went in and had a talk to him. And, yeah, and he basically offered me the drive for the endurance races in the knowing that the two Euros were coming out.
Ivan Muller and Jason Plato were coming for Bathurst, but they couldn't come for Queensland.
No. Yeah. So he said, look, you and Todd would partner up in the second HRT car, and then when the two Euros come out for Bathurst, you and Todd will drive the my car entry at Bathurst. So we'll run a three-car entry team at Bathurst. And I'm like, wow, I mean, this is incredible, you know, just from someone that had kind of thought that this is it then and the taxis and all the rest of it were going to be my life then pretty much. That, and then I kind of got really nervous and edge of my seat sort of stuff because I knew, and he goes, and as for the money, and I go, here we go. And I just went white and I think I'd started shivering and he said, we'll pay you X amount. And I thought, and how much am I paying you? I don't get, you're going to pay me, but out of my money that I'm paying you. And he just said, so that's a deal. And we'll put a performance package in place as well for top three. And so there you go. How does that sound? I'm like, I don't think I could even talk. Just as it turned out, you know, you read about this stuff. You don't really. I hadn't heard about it too often happen to someone because
it's rare.
It takes mega money. Rare. Yeah. And that's why I guess even to this day I'm quite bitter about motorsport because there's so many kids out there with raw talent, and they just can't get a go because it takes a lot of money. Mm. You know, we know of plenty of families and plenty of guys that have raced at the elite level that have started off through their parents mortgaging their houses and so on. And anyway, that's another story. But I went out and told Dad and he basically, he cried.
He's been waiting in the car.
Yeah, for hours, just sitting in the car. Yeah, and yeah, and he basically cried, you know, and I just thought that was one of the proudest moments of my racing career, knowing that it wasn't going to cost us any money. And yes, I wasn't going to get paid much, but there was not a big outlay and I was going to drive for the factory Holden racing team, which was, I couldn't even say it was a childhood dream because it was not something that I'd ever thought about. You know, you look at these guys and these teams and how cool they are. Yeah, way up in the clouds. And as it turned out, to get that opportunity and for Dad to have that tear in his eye and all the rest of it, it was really cool. Still to this day, one of the best moments of my life.
And you roll out at Queensland Raceway, as you said, with Todd in the second. So this is just put the positioning around this. The Holden Racing team at the time is Craig Lowndes and Mark Scaife. They have won 96, 98, 99. They're the dominant team. They've changed. They're the red cars from that year onwards. They have got uber resource, great people. They've got the biggest cricket bat at the time, basically. Mm. And they've just given you the keys to one of their cars for the Queensland 500.
Yeah.
This is just incredulous. This is fairy tale stuff.
Yeah, it is. And I, yeah, as I said, I'm really privileged to have that opportunity because I know to this day you don't hear about this sort of story happening too often. So definitely a fairy tale for sure. And to be part of that fairy tale is really cool, something that, you know, I can't wait to tell my kids when they really understand a bit more and grandkids later on down the track because, yeah, as I said, it just doesn't happen and it was a really good race. We went up there with that. I had that same mentality. Even though driving for the factory, we had massive resources. You know, a lot of money behind that team. It was the factory team and it was one of those teams that no one wanted to leave. All the crew guys, there was not a revolving door. It was if you're in it, the whole racing team, you're in. And they all stayed. These are guys, stalwarts, that had been there a very long time and some of them still there.
Yeah.
Which is really cool to see as well. And, yeah, and we had a good race. I mean, it was unfortunate because I did my part on that same analogy of just hand the car over to Todd. Todd's been racing and he's the main driver. I know what my job is. And that's just to hand the car over to Todd in one piece. Not a burnt-out, wrecked car with damaged panels and all the rest of it and destroy our chances and the race team's chances, but just to back up, I guess, Mark and Craig as well and do the job that I guess Jeff had employed me to do. And, yeah, and it was all going along really well. Todd was in for that last stint and doing a fantastic job and we were running second to Craig and Mark. And I think it was, I don't know, how many laps to go? It was
not many. No, it was close-ish to the end.
Yeah, unfortunately, and got a hole in the radiator. Mm. And then that little race was put to bed, unfortunately. But I was proud of the job that Todd and I did, and it was really cool. It was a great team to be a part of, and to have that race. And it was we were excited. I was really excited then going to Bathurst and driving with Todd, even in the my car entry, knowing that we were going to be a third car and driving around Bathurst, the most iconic track in Australia, in a factory backed car.
And you finished fifth.
Yeah, and we finished fifth.
So you go from 1 year with your own clunker, just trying to get it onto the track and just get into the race, to turning up, 12 months later driving for HRT. And you guys outpointed the Euros. Like, the reality was you smoked them.
It was cool. I mean, we knew the track, and I know a lot of the Euros, they come over now, and, because of simulators and stuff now where they can do a lot of different miles on some of these high-end simulators, they get their head around the track a lot quicker now when they come over. But I guess a couple of steps back, when we were testing at Phillip Island in the My Car entry in the lead-up, and Rob Crawford was looking after the Holden Young Lions, which
became Kmart, didn't it?
That's right.
The nucleus of that team rolled into Kmart.
Yeah, even though it was HYL, the Holden Young Lions, I was in no delusional fact that I was a middle-aged lion, not a young lion at my age to get, that job in the HYL team was really cool, but I was no young lion by any means. But in the testing and the lead up to it, I'd just done the best time that I'd done around Phillip Island. The car was about a week out from Bathurst, even though the team goes up there on that weekend before. So I guess it's probably 2 weeks from Bathurst. And I'd just gone across the line, the best time I'd done, feeling really good. Rob was on the radio to me. I went through Southern Loop, just lapsed concentration for one, not like a tenth of a second. And just ran wide just because I was, he was pumping me up so much and I felt really good. I just didn't brake hard enough, even on a slowdown lap, and ran wide, and I just side-slapped the tyres. And, oh, my God, I went from that, not hero, but just to zero in such a quick time. And we come back around, once the car come and got us out and we come back around the pits, I felt so small. I just felt so deflated and disappointed in what I'd done, because that's not in my nature to go and crash a car, and certainly in practice. And I just remember Todd pulling me aside, and Rob just come and said to me, a couple of things about, you need to get your head right now. Look, he had a couple of stern words, but not too bad. And then so Todd and I left the track that afternoon. I was staying down because I was still living in Wodonga, and I was staying with Todd. And Todd pulled me aside. We went fishing that afternoon. He took me fishing because I felt just unbelievably bad.
Because this goes against your grain of how you've been racing.
100%. I'm like, I want to go into the race team to help them, to get this car. And Todd's like, no, they'll get it sorted. It's fine. It's all good. And I just remember Todd saying, he went and spoke to Rob, and he said to Rob, mate, whatever you say to him right now, I've already seen him, whatever you say, you're not going to make him feel any worse than what he already feels now. And I thought it was really mature of Todd to go to Rob and say that sort of thing. And that's why Rob was really cool to me. He didn't rip into me. He just said, just get your head right. We'll get the car fixed. Go away and just have a think about it. That's all. And then when Todd told me that, I thought, really mature of Todd to say that, because honestly, I felt lower than a footprint as it was. There was nothing anyone could have said to me that was going to make me feel any worse. But, we bounced back. I bounced back, and we had a really good lead up to Bathurst, and I guess at Bathurst to finish fifth was really cool. It was a really memorable race for me, that's for sure.
So you couldn't get away from the Kelly brothers in this early stage of your TWR Australia connection, because the next year, we'd seen Todd. He'd come along through Formula Ford, Formula Holden, got into the V8s, won a race in Canberra in 2000, but everyone kept saying, there's another Kelly coming and he's better. Or, some people were saying he was better, some people were saying he was just as good.
Yeah.
That Rick arrives through Formula Ford, Formula Holden, and then you get Rick for the next year in Kmart cars. So tell us about the he was like, 18 or something?
Yeah,
at the time?
He was.
I remember really young.
We were testing it at Calder, and I remember him rocking up in like a Falcon Ute that he'd put a spark plug and everything in the exhaust, to have one of those flamethrowers out the back. And that was typical. I just knew. And this is
this is a different Kelly.
Yeah, this is a different Kelly for sure. And when he rocked up, I've still got the photo. The original photo I took of him with his first drive in one of the Kmart cars at Calder for his first laps around, and it was unreal to be a part of as well. To know that then they instilled, I guess, their trust in me to nurture Rick in a supercar for Bathurst and so on, which was, yeah, it was really cool that next year to be part of that.
So by this point, are you ingraining? Because one of the things, you became part of the furniture with the Holden side of things, whether it was the extracurricular stuff and the rallying and the Nations Cup and all that stuff. And then, of course, driving the Enduros with whichever team you were with. By this stage, has the Holden relationship kind of got going? Because that's something they did very well, was that they put their arms around all their teams and their drivers and treated as Holden Motorsport, where I don't think the Blue side did that stuff quite as well. Were you feeling part of the family at that stage after that first HRT year? And you've got a deal on the table that you're good for a couple of years, you don't have to worry about next year or what, where, why?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. Like with Creno, part of the TWR banner, and, with obviously driving for Tom was a really cool privilege. But then to have, I guess, John Stevenson, who we vaguely knew, who helped us out back in the Oscar days, gave us the odd shell and a few parts, but I'd never really met him. It was all just through relationship with Dad and talking to him, and he helped us out back in the Oscar days. And then I guess with Simon McNamara then being involved, and it was a nice relationship and a really cool family unity to be a part of. And as you said, they really looked after all their umbrella of drivers, and it was really nice to be, I guess, one of those spokes in that umbrella, because being a kid up in the country, I got a car every 3 to 5 months that I could just put some Ks on. I had some really nice cars. Being a middle-aged 25 to 28-year-old, to have really nice factory road cars, every time they come out, I'd have the latest thing. It looked like I was making money, but in reality, no one knew. I was like a magician.
So even though you're doing a couple of races a year for the Enduros, what are you doing during the year to keep yourself ticking? Well, is the taxi still going? Is the Sunnycross job stopped?
I had to actually stop driving the taxi, and that was purely no arrogance thing, other than I had had that many people. After I signed the contract with TWR, there was being our local rag, the Border Mail up there, and if it wasn't Brad or Brad or Brad Jones in the in the rag up there, I got the odd little clip.
You got the dregs.
Yeah. And then, I made a little snippet on the front page, knowing that, local boy gets big deal contract. Not big money, but big deal, with part of the Holden Factory Racing team to sign for them. And then, so I'm driving the taxi on a Friday or Saturday night, and I'd get drunken people, which I got used to just picking them up and taking them to the next bar or taking them home and doing all that sort of thing. And then more often than not, then after that contract and a bit of the radio press and paper press, that people started to recognize me a little bit more. And then it's like, you're that race car driver, get me home faster and all the rest of it. It's like, I'll get you home, mate. I'll get you home safe at my speed, And then so I was actually copping a fair bit of abuse then about,
Wodonga's not that big a place.
You need to go faster. You need to do this. And, show us. You're not that race car driver and all this. So I thought to myself, I just didn't want that anymore. And because I enjoyed it. The taxi stuff paid reasonably well. I mean, but it just got to a point. It was just getting a little bit too hard to keep driving the taxi with people forcing me and wanting me to drive faster than I was comfortable with. And let's be honest, it was a Falcon.
I don't think the powers that be that were paying you for some supercar racing would have been that thrilled to know that that's what you were driving on other stages.
And that's part one of the podcast with Nathan Pretty. Hope you've enjoyed the story so far. Part two comes at you next week on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Repco. Of course, don't forget, every Tuesday, the Castrol Motorsport News podcast back. Wednesday for the V8 Sleuth podcast, and then Thursdays or Fridays, it is Repco Supercars Weekly, as we bring you all the latest and greatest from the Repco Supercars Championship. Hey, I wanted to say quickly before we sign off for this episode, thank you for your support. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Thank you for getting engaged, sending through your questions. We'll have the National Motor Racing Museum Couch Racer questions with Nathan in part two next week. But we love to hear from you. We love your feedback. Please leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Tell all your friends. We want more people listening to the V8 Sleuth podcast. We've got over 200 episodes in the back catalogue for you to go back through. If you haven't heard them all, you better get cracking, because we're going to keep punching them out every week. Next week, part two of Nathan Pretty. I hope you enjoyed this one, and we'll chat to you very soon.